Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Washington Post reporter Christian Davenport spent 3 weeks in Iraq, embedded with the Virginia Army National Guard unit. He followed five of the soldiers home, spent time with their families, and now writes about how these new veterans coped with their readjustment to civilian life. He tells their stories in a new book. It's titled As You Were. And Christian Davenport joins me in the studio. Throughout the hour, we'll welcome your calls, comments, questions. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Christian. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, one of the major characters in your book is Miranda Summers, the sorority girl from William and Mary. But, you know, I was fascinated with the fact that Ray Johnson was called up to serve in Iraq. He was a 58-year-old grandfather. How come?
Well, not only were you surprised, but his wife was surprised as well when he got called up. Ray, to me, was just a fascinating person who served not just in Iraq, but he had served in Vietnam as well and had flown Hueys in Vietnam and had just a harrowing experience in Vietnam. And then came home from that war and was still in the National Guard after all this time and was training younger pilots to go off to war and to fly in combat. And he thought, you know, this isn't right. If all these young kids are going, I've already had experience flying in combat, I should go too. And so he raised his hand and said to his commanders, look, if you need anybody, I know I'm 58 and I may not be, you know, the pilot or the soldier that I once was, but I've got some valuable experience, I'll go. And so, you know, they needed soldiers.
They needed them. His wife, Diane, was not very happy.
She didn't understand it at all. Even though they had been married and he had been in the Guard the whole time, she thought it was the National Guard, meaning just that, the National Guard, that he would respond to hurricanes and floods and that sort of thing. But never did she imagine he would go off to be flying in Iraq, and especially at his age. She's thinking, she had in her mind thoughts of their retirement home. They had grandchildren. So at this time, they're thinking about retirement. All of a sudden, she's preparing herself for this deployment. And it was so amazing because I thought he was such a fascinating person and someone I wanted to follow. But her story as well and how she coped while he was away.
She felt resentment, and she also felt that he was being selfish as far as she was concerned.
Right. She was quite angry.
Yeah.
Because he had told her time and again, I'm not going to be deployed. It's just not going to happen. In fact, during the first Persian Gulf War, someone called her and said, well, is Ray going to go? And it didn't even occur to her that he would go. And then this time around, when 9/11 happened, she thought, you're going to go. And he says, no, I'm way too old. And he was a Chief Warrant Officer 5, and there aren't a lot of slots for CW5s in a lot of units. So she thought, too, his rank prevented him from going. And, yeah, she did not take it well and was quite upset.
And there is a lot more about Diane and her travails, and she had lots of them, not only in her home but outside. I'm talking with Christian Davenport. His new book is titled As You Were to War and Back with the Black Hawk Battalion of the Virginia National Guard. Tell me why you decided to focus on the National Guard.
Well, as a reporter at the Post, I had written a lot about the Guard and Reserves. And early on in the war, in 2004, I embedded with a reserve unit and came home with them just to do the story of them coming home. And that story ended with one of the reservists slipping their key into their front door and walking in home for the first time. And that was the ending. That was one of the last scenes. And I said, you know, that's not the ending. That's the beginning of the story.
Absolutely.
And so much of the attention is focused on the active duty. These, you know, the Marines and the 101st Airborne and the Army and the active duty. But the fact is, in this war and in these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we've relied so heavily on our reservists. And I think their sacrifice is unique and has been largely unheralded, because as soon as their war is over, it's almost like, poof, okay, back to civilian life with you. And there you go. Now try to pick up, you know, going back with your family, to your old jobs, to your old lives. And that's the story I wanted to tell.
And certainly those jobs are not always waiting.
Unfortunately, no.
You talk about Miranda Summers, mm-hmm. and she is, as you've written and as I've said, a sorority girl from William and Mary. She signed up, really, to get the monetary support for college. But she signed up and got a very unusual position.
Yeah, well, she signed up because she needed the money, that's for sure. She also signed up because she felt the duty to do it. And when the unit was deploying to Iraq and getting ready to train, she was a supply sergeant. And she thought, well, if I'm going to Iraq, if I'm going to do this, why be in the rear in the gear, as they say, the whole time? So she saw a sign-up sheet. They needed volunteers to be door gunners for the Blackhawks. They're the ones, you know, with the machine guns hanging out the doors. And at first she thought, well, I'm not qualified to do that because I'm a woman. And then she saw on the sign-up sheet that one of her fellow female soldiers had signed up for it. And she said, well, if she can do it, I'm going to do it too. And wouldn't you know it, Miranda got picked. And so in addition to her supply duties, she also went on some missions as a door gunner in a Black Hawk helicopter.
How long did that training for her take?
Well, the unit first started at Fort Dix, and then they moved to Yuma, Arizona, where they were training with the Marines. So it was a good 6 months before they actually were in Iraq.
Well, tell me how that position actually functions.
Well, for Miranda, there are crew chiefs and there are door gunners.
Okay.
And the crew chiefs also act as mechanics in case anything goes wrong. But a door gunner is there, you know, just as it sounds. They are there with their fingers on the trigger, looking for insurgents, looking to ward off danger. And there you are. And, you know, and I flew with the unit a few times, and I was glad to be sitting behind them and glad that they were there, because you never know what you're going to face. And as you're going out, it can be, you know, miles upon miles of desert, almost hypnotic, and in a strange way, very beautiful, too. But that's not obviously what they're focusing on. They're focusing on looking for the bad guys, and that's what Miranda did. And she went right from being, and I think this is what's so compelling about these citizen soldiers, right from the first semester of her senior year at William & Mary, where she's at the Kappa Delta sorority and just going along like every other college kid. And then, boom, a few months later, she is in Anbar province behind a machine gun in a Black Hawk helicopter.
When she came home to, before she left, but after she had signed up to tell her mother what she was going to do, her mother almost fainted.
And you know, what was fascinating about all of that, too, her family obviously had a very strong reaction to her deployment, as they all do. And her father had warned her, you know, if you are going to join the Army and the National Guard, you're going to go. And she went in knowing full well she was going to go. But when she had to come back and break the news to her sorority, that's where it was, you know. Now, many of them in the sorority, they didn't even know she was in the National Guard, because it's not exactly the coolest thing on a college campus to be in the Guard. So she would sneak out for her 1 weekend a month.
She wouldn't tell them where she was.
She didn't tell a lot.
Going.
No, sir, her close friends knew, but a lot of the people didn't know. So there she was, early Saturday morning in her uniform, going off to drill. And of course, campus then was completely empty. But by Sunday night, when she would come back to campus, she would change out of her uniform and be in her civilian clothes so that nobody would know. And so when she got the word that she was going to Iraq, it happened to be right in the middle of Pledge Week, of all things, for the sorority. So she rushes back to be with her sorority, takes off her uniform, puts on this black satin dress and pearls, which was, I guess, the uniform for this evening, and breaks the news to her entire sorority that I'm going to Iraq. And they were surprised, A, because they didn't even know she was in the Guard, and B, that she could go to Iraq. And the reaction she got, I mean, I think is very telling about this big cultural divide in our society, you know, between those who serve and those who don't. I mean, they were just dumbfounded. They asked her things like, well, will you have to cut your hair? Will you kill anybody? Are you prepared for this? And, you know, she's just trying to wrap her mind around it herself. And one of the people actually asked her, well, I thought only poor people went to war.
Really?
Yeah.
Stunning division when you think about it. Division of mentality, division of worldview, division of sense of responsibility. Mm-hmm. But as you said, she knew full well when she joined the National Guard that she was likely to be called up.
Right. And she had a sense the summer before her senior year that she might be going. And so she took some extra credits that summer in case she was deployed. And then right in the middle of her first semester at the beginning, there she goes, and she got a few teachers to give her independent studies. So in addition to her flak jacket and her machine gun, she takes books with her and does these independent studies, sometimes after very long days and long missions, sends them in by email. She wrote once that she lost in her journal, which are just fabulous, which we quote in the book, about how the terrorists ate her homework because they lost power and lost her paper.
Christian Davenport of the Washington Post. His new book is titled As You Were, To War and Back. Stay with us. And we're back with Christian Davenport. He's written a new book. It's titled As You Were, To War and Back, with the Black Hawk Battalion of the Virginia National Guard, in which he focuses on five people who indeed were part of the National Guard unit and were deployed to Iraq. We've been talking in the last few moments about Miranda Summers, who was a sorority member from William and Mary College. She signed up primarily because she needed the money for college, and she truly had a desire to serve her country. But she kind of ran into some funny situations. Read for us that portion, Christian.
Sure. This is the part when she's doing her homework from Iraq so that she can graduate from William and Mary on time, even though she's in Iraq. When Al-Asad, and Al-Asad is the base that they were stationed, when Al-Asad came under fire 2 months into the deployment, the base lost power, making her lose several pages of the paper she'd been working on for school. Crawling around in body armor, sitting in a bunker and thinking about how people want to kill me ruins my chain of thought, she wrote in her journal. How do you write your professors and tell them that the terrorists ate your homework?
Good grief. Really something. Tell us a little more about Ray Johnson and his wife because, as you said earlier, she became a subject of fascination for you as well as Ray.
Right, and here I was in Iraq, and I had met Ray there. And I thought, wow, what a great story he has to tell, being in Vietnam and then going to Iraq. And I was just interested in how he would come to terms fighting in both of those wars. And so when we came back to the States, I was so focused on him. And I had met his wife, Diane, but at first I wasn't paying much attention to her. But then as I got to know her better and got to know her story and realized that her deployment, so to speak, on the home front was more difficult in a lot of ways than his.
Such as?
Well, as Ray says, you know, anything that could go wrong did go wrong. And it was this series of just, you know, almost tragicomedy events. And here she was, she had lost her husband to Iraq, and thinking, oh my, and having never expected this. And then it was just sort of one folly after another. She had a swarm of bees in her house. She had, right before Ray left, they had totally renovated the basement. And she had said, ugh, why would we launch on this renovation project right before you leave? But he said, oh, it'll be nice to come home to this nice finished basement. And as soon as he goes, she realizes the electrical is just, it's a mess. It's a fire hazard. And she gets someone to come in and fix it. And it's just, it's an absolute mess. It's you know, months and months and thousands of dollars of work. And so she goes all this, and then there's flooding. And
flooding
then
in the basement.
Termites
and
all of this. And she's going through all of this, and the person she wants and the person she needs most is in Iraq. But because he's in Iraq, she doesn't want to burden him with her problems. And so she doesn't tell him what's going on. And it's real. I mean, one thing after another, her car gets egged. I mean, it's almost like the fates are mocking her. And at some point, Ray senses that whatever it is, something's not right at home. And he knows just from the tone of her voice, even though she's insisting, no, no, honey, everything's okay. And he says, he calls his best friend, and he was on a phone conversation with Diane, and he calls his best friend and says, can you please go over and check on her? I think she's having a nervous breakdown.
Mm.
And she was right there. I mean, she had a very difficult time. And in a lot of ways, came through the experience a much more independent, a much stronger person than she had been before.
She was almost afraid to see Ray when he came home because she realized how much she had changed.
That's right.
While I was gone.
That's right. And that was, there's a scene in the book where she needed to renew her military ID. And the old Diane would have, you know, been very passive. She was a librarian in La Plata and was very passive, very quiet, not very assertive. But the new Diane became much stronger and much more assertive during
this
whole process.
And the bureaucracy she went through just to get that ID renewed was the silliest thing I've ever heard.
Right. And then she would agree with you. And she fought and fought and finally got it and insisted, no, I'm going to get this ID and I'm going to get it right now. And the picture on her ID is the picture of the new Diane.
And she's angry.
And she's angry. And she
really
looked at
is.
It and almost didn't recognize herself. And that's when she had this moment where she knew she had changed, and she was very concerned that when Ray got home, he would detect this and that he wouldn't love the new Diane.
And?
Well, it's a nice, happy love story, but there were some tensions. It's very hard, you know, when soldiers come home from
But surely that's got to be the story for every single couple reunited after however long the experience is. I mean, the very experience of being in Iraq, being exposed to that kind of warfare, that kind of pending danger, and then coming home and trying to behave naturally.
Mm-hmm.
As though, you know, everything's okay now. I can just function. You know, you begin to wonder who it is who has PTSD. And it sounds to me as though Diane was suffering in one way from PTSD, as perhaps many of the people left behind are doing.
Yeah, no, she certainly had some very dark times. very difficult times and came through it. And it's interesting you mentioned the bit about, you know, the difficulty of relationships. One of the things that I saw, you know, with the unit and with the soldiers I was with, and I chronicle one of their experiences, is that many of them come home not just to difficult relationships, but to broken ones. And there were a lot of divorces in the unit that we saw. And one of them, you know, it's interesting when we think about, you know, the cheating spouse back home, we often think about, you know, the wife running off. But in this case, the one I chronicled, it was the husband who was, you know, off cheating, and it was the wife who was the soldier in Iraq having to come to terms with that. And in this case, it's another person in the book, Kate Broom, who she was in the unit an army medic. And so because this was a Black Hawk unit, not an infantry unit, not on the ground kicking in doors and that sort of thing, but in Black Hawks in the sky, she probably saw more of war's horror than any other man in the unit. And so here she is. She had just gone through a traumatic experience where she was a medic and was suddenly diverted to an awful scene where a bomb had gone off and a Marine had been severely injured. And she was there to treat him and probably saved his life and put a tourniquet on his leg, but had gone through this just incredibly traumatic experience, and then a few weeks later finds out that her husband is leaving her. And this 1-2 punch, boom, hit her. And again, you know, we think so much about the active duty, but what was getting her through Iraq was thinking, you know, I'm going to go home. I'm going to see my husband. We're going to have this. And that was her safety net. And she was holding on to that, and then suddenly it was taken away from her.
800-433-8850. Do join us. I look forward to hearing from you. First, let's go to Pamela, who's in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Pamela, you're on the air.
Thank you so much, Diane. Good morning. And I'm thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'm a lifelong fan, so I'm so delighted to be this first-time caller.
Good.
And, Mr. Davenport, I look forward to getting your book this afternoon at Borders, by the way.
Thank you.
So thank you for writing it. And, Diane, what you just referred to recently has sort of made what I'm going to share perhaps a little easier for me as I was listening. I was in the National Guard and stationed in Iraq for 1 year, and formerly I was, prior to leaving, was a special ed teacher in an inner city school. And I came home with, I guess I'm sharing now, you know, post-traumatic stress issues, and more or less tried to keep them under wraps as privately as I could, and attempted to return to work and this and that. And I just want to preface it by saying I wish almost I had two broken arms, because that post-traumatic stress is so complicated and people don't get it. And I what I struggled with my family was they didn't want to hear about really life abroad. I would often hear, but this is reality, this is life, meaning life here in the United States. And for me, once you view tragedy and injury and death, for me, I was forever altered, and my reality became a new reality and a new normal for me, but not for anyone else. And to combine the two, again, people would say, well, look, let's talk about life, real life. And I would keep hearing this struggle with real life here and kind of dispelling that life, you know, existed as it
sure
did over there.
Pamela, and let me ask you, were you able to get help for yourself after you got home? And how hard was it to get some help?
Diane, it was extremely difficult in that, there's an also, for me, I found an expectation of post-traumatic stress and anxiety, and that from the help that I was receiving, a bit discouraging in that it was supposed to be after 3 months, it's, well, now we've fixed you, you're all better, you know, let's pick up and go back, and it doesn't quite work like that.
Christian, how typical is that?
Well, that's what Kate went through to a large degree. She had a very hard time getting help. And one of the difficult things is that at first, what's hard is you have to admit that you need help. And when you're in the Army, to raise your hand and say, I need help, can be a difficult thing. But she did that because she knew she needed help, because she had been through these experiences. So when she got home, what happened to her, and it sounds like Pamela had a similar experience, was she made an appointment to go to the VA And it took Kate, I think, 4 or 6 weeks to get an appointment. And she went in and said, you know, look, I had been diagnosed. She had already at that point had been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder on when she was coming back through Fort Dix for their demobilization. And she went in for a consultation at the VA and said, I need help. I need to see somebody. And they ran through a checklist and gave her sort of a good review. And then I think it was about 4 weeks later, she finally got her referrals to say, okay, now I'm going to get help. And she opens it up and she had a referral for smoking cessation. And she didn't get help. And so at this point, she had been home for several months. And it took a long time for her to get the help that she needed, and had a very hard time just getting through. I sat with her once, and she was calling the VA, and we timed it. She was on hold for 30 minutes, and we sat there, and on my stopwatch, we timed. She was on hold with the VA for 30 minutes just to talk to a real human being.
And when she did?
Oh, she hung up after 30 minutes completely frustrated and angry. And she called back every day that week and stayed on hold for 10 minutes. And she promised me she would do that and then didn't get help at all.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to San Antonio, Texas. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi. My husband, we were stationed at Fort Hood when my husband deployed. And we lived in military housing, and one of the things that helped me survive this deployment with three teenage boys and is the fact that we lived in military housing. We were surrounded by other women and a few men who were coping with the same thing. But one of the, talking about the tragedy slash comedy of it is my oldest son attended his first dance, and so I'm helping him get ready, and he's real nervous, and I realize I have no clue how to tie a tie. So, you know, I go to my next-door neighbor, do you know how to tie a tie? No. So we are running around the neighborhood trying to find some man who can tie this tie for us. Finally found somebody whose husband was home on mid-tour leave about 6 houses down. But, you know, it was just so typical, though, of what life is. You don't realize it's the little things that you don't realize. And there were times when I really resented my husband because here he is in Iraq and he's bonding with his buddies and we're talking every night and he's telling me, you know, yes, he was in danger. Yes, it was a very life-threatening situation. But he was bonding with these people and here I am trying to figure out, you know.
How to tie a tie. You know, it's so interesting that human beings have such a hard time putting themselves in the other's shoe, and that Karen recognizes her husband's in danger, but she's thinking about the bonding that's going on. It's crossed wires somehow, Christian.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that's interesting to me about that, she's at Fort Hood.
Exactly.
She's surrounded by people whose husbands are also deployed.
Right.
And then there are people like Diane where nobody around her is in the same situation. And yes, they're her good friends and her best friends, but they can't sympathize with her and empathize because they don't have a loved one in Iraq and there's no way they can understand it. And what happens there, too, is when the soldiers come home, these reservists, these guardsmen, which is why I wanted to write about them, they're just, boom, civilians again in a society that has never been so divorced from its military and so unaffected by the wars the military is fighting. As somebody said, this is one of the first wars where the military went to war and the rest of us really went to the mall. And that disconnect, I think it's, you know, less than 1% of the American population serves. And I think in American society, like race and class and religion and all of that, that is one of the huge fault lines here. And so it can be very difficult. And what I found, you know, it's interesting. She was talking about finding someone to tie a tie and how do you relate this experience and what's it like to go through. They at least knew what it was like.
Mm.
And these soldiers would come home and they wouldn't know how. People would say, well, what was it like? What was the war like? And what I found was so many would answer that by saying, it was hot. It was hot. Because anybody can understand that. It's weather. Sure, it's hot. But if they push and you want to know what it was really like, well, they don't really get into that. And that can be very difficult.
It was interesting that Miranda Summers was asked what she did by a number of veterans. How did that conversation go?
Well, this was a story where Miranda was, she came home and she was home for about 2 months. And she was with some friends, complete civilians, who were not in the Army. And she snuck away to the World War II memorial, which she thought would be a way to be welcomed home. And she met these World War II vets with her who didn't think she could possibly be a soldier. But when they realized she was, they took her in like they were all comrades.
And the book is titled As You Were, To War and Back with the Black Hawk Battalion of the Virginia National Guard. Christian Davenport is the author.
Support for NPR comes from Families USA, working for a high-quality, affordable health care for everyone and collecting personal health care stories at familiesusa.org. From Travelers Insurance, providing coverage under the red umbrella since the Lincoln administration. More information at travelers.com. And from LendingTree, where you can choose from up to 4 customized loan offers. 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win. LendingTree.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Joseph O'Neill, author of the novel Netherland. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan compared it to The Great Gatsby. President Obama has said he's reading it. And Roya Hakakian of the Iran Human Rights Documentation Center returns to talk about growing up Jewish in revolutionary Iran. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And if you've just joined us, Christian Davenport is with me. He's a reporter for the Washington Post. He embedded with a unit of the Virginia National Guard that went to Iraq. He went with them and came back with them. His new book about that experience is titled As You Were. And we're going to take more of your calls. Here's an email from Michael in Cleveland, Ohio, who says the disbelief that the young college student got from her friends when they learned she was going to war reminds me of the reaction I got when I returned from Vietnam. Quote, "Why did you let this happen to you?" was essentially what they said, implying that anyone with any brains could avoid military service with a deferment. The Vietnam War spawned more law school, grad school applicants than any single event in history.
Well, and the big difference then, of course, was the draft. And in Vietnam, I think that war, while a lot of people got out of going, and could find deferments, it still touched a large portion of the society in a way this war doesn't.
And made the whole country think about that war. Do you think we ought to go back to a draft?
I don't really have a position on that, but what bothers me is how disconnected we are from the military. And if you think, and this is in part why I wanted to write about the National Guard, because the National Guard is descended from the colonial militia. It's got this long history. And when the founding fathers were building a new republic, they purposefully rooted the military in the citizenry. And this is came as they're casting off a tyrant and a king who had a professional standing army that he could use at his disposal to wage war. And they thought the more democratic ideal was to have the military in the citizenry so that when the country went to war, the whole country would rise up and go to war. And this could very well serve as a check against the executive. And that's the way it had been for so long in World War I and World War II. The National Guard went off to war. You know, the old colonial militia fought our wars. The 29th Infantry Division, under which the unit I was embedded with was under, stormed the beaches of Normandy on World War II. We got away from that in Vietnam when LBJ left, for the most part, the Guard at home. And this was largely for political reasons, because the Guard had become a haven for people who didn't go to war, which, think about that for a minute. Why would a National Guard, a military unit, be a way to get out of going to war? Well, in large part, LBJ didn't have to worry about that because he had a draft. He had a steady stream, a steady supply of soldiers to go to war. But this time around, and afterwards, that really upset the military leaders, who would have liked to have the Guard going to Vietnam. Not that they're the best soldiers, but certainly they would be better off than draftees who were taken off the street, trained, and sent to war. At least the people in the Guard had volunteered for it. What happened was, after Vietnam, the military leader said, they'll never take us to war without the reserves again. And this was right after Vietnam, and it's a history we've largely forgotten. But we think of the National Guard, it's one of our oldest and most venerable institutions, and had played such a key role in every conflict except for Vietnam. So then here we are in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Guard goes. But we're not connected to the war, and that bridge that the Guard once provided isn't there anymore.
Let's go to Edwardsville, Illinois. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, and thank you, Mr. Davenport, for what you're doing here to raise the consciousness of the American public on this subject. I have a son in Afghanistan, and every day I have the image in my mind of two soldiers walking down my driveway to deliver some news, and it's called anticipatory grief, and it is extremely common in military families. It's normal. The American public does not actually support these deployments for several reasons. Number one, they're not paying for it out of their own pockets since it's been charged on the Bank of China MasterCharge card. Number two, most Americans don't even know someone who's been or will be deployed. For another reason, according to the Department of Defense website, 242,000 contractors are doing much of the work, and many of those are foreign nationals in the area of operations. So all of these things effectively keep the reality of constant war off the consciousness of Mr. and Mrs. America. If we're going to have constant war, the American public should get a bill for it in their mailbox. Number two, the draft should be instituted, and that will result in immense pressure on the government to end these foreign deployments. But the way it's structured is that it's off the consciousness of Mr. and Mrs. America.
Yes. Bill, thank you so much for your call. And I must say, I hope you never, ever see those two officers walking up your driveway. I do hope your son stays safe. What about his comments, Chris?
Well, I mean, you can tell he feels very much alone in that, because he probably doesn't know a lot of other people who are in that situation. And it would seems like it would help immensely if he had somebody else who had a son or daughter in Afghanistan he could talk to. And now, the military does provide family support groups, but sometimes in the Guard and Reserve, you know, the soldiers are quite spread out geographically, and so they're not always connected to those people.
You know, there's one more thing here about the National Guard, which is that when most of these young people signed up for the National Guard, They had no idea they might be called up for war in Iraq.
Well, certainly before 9/11, that was the case.
Exactly.
And the Guard's own motto used to be, and I think they use this less frequently, join the Guard, get your degree tuition free. And now, if you see the advertisements for the Guard, they're much more about responding to hurricanes and these Katrina-like images, and these images that are clearly combat-related. Because if you join the Guard now, you should know you're probably going.
And that's all there is to it. Bill, thanks so much for your call. I want to ask you, Christian, how you have been affected by your experience of being with these individuals, by your coming back. I realize you were not there quite as long as they were, but nevertheless, you were part of a group, you came back, you had to reintegrate in your own life.
Yeah, it's, you know, I was just there for a few weeks, and embedding is always a difficult process, and especially I came at the very end of the tour, and you always wonder how a Washington Post reporter is going to be welcomed, you know, among these hardened soldiers and the image you have. And a few days after getting to Iraq, I was kind of sitting alone in the chow hall a lot. I wasn't, you know, being welcomed. But a few days afterwards, the battalion commander invited me to play touch football with some of the guys, and we were playing touch football, and they were, of course, being soldiers, all trash talking to each other. And finally, the battalion commander threw me a touchdown pass, and I caught it, and I turned to the other team and said, "That's right, I'm embedded. I'm embedded in your end zone." And it seemed after that I was much more welcome. But coming home with them, I mean, I would say I was inspired by them, and it was really my privilege to spend so much time with them on the home front and to be with them as they were making their way home. And, you know, when this was, from the very beginning, going to be a story about coming home
exactly.
from war. What happens
exactly.
after the war.
Yeah.
What it's like to come back to a society that really doesn't understand this war. And so my wife said to me, "Well, if it's a story about what happens after the war, why are you going to Iraq?" And she wasn't too pleased with that. But I said, I really wanted to get a sense of what it is they're coming home from. And I think that helped greatly. And I think it helped me get a much better sense of what it is they went through and who they were in Iraq versus who they were at home, and to see them change and to follow them. Miranda, for example, Summers, who we were talking about earlier, came back, and because she graduated on time from William and Mary, went the following fall to Brown University to get her master's. And imagine being an Iraq war vet at Brown University. I mean, and when she went there for the first time, she needed help paying for her GI Bill. And so she went to the registrar, and the secretary, you know, said, "Well, I don't know. We don't have this problem very much." And she said, "Well, you've got to have somebody on staff who can help me. You're required." And, you know, it just, again, showed that disconnect between us and them.
What about Ray and Diane? How long did it take them to get past the changes that had occurred in both their lives?
Well, it took quite a while. And one of the things I found so fascinating about it, again, Ray was a veteran not only of Iraq, but of Vietnam as well.
Right.
And he never talked to Diane about Vietnam. He was so closed off about that experience. And she just didn't push because he never talked. And she figured he'd talk about that when he was ready. And so he had been home for several months after home from Iraq. And he didn't talk much about that either. And so she thought, well, here we go again, another one of these. And one day he comes up from the basement and he's got a magazine ad. I think it's from American Legion or the VFW magazine. And it's for tours of Vietnam, for Vietnam veterans. And he says, "I think we should go to Vietnam and I want to show you that." And so now she's wondering, well, if he's just now at the point where he can talk about Vietnam, how long will it be before he can talk about Iraq and what that experience has meant?
Did they go to Vietnam?
Now they're enjoying their semi-retirement, and they've got several trips planned. I believe it's on the list, but they had a cruise first. Although she did, right when they got home, What Diane did was, in her newfound independence and aplomb, she scheduled a surprise trip, and she took them to, I believe it was North Carolina, to the place where they were married shortly after he got home. And it was this surprise, and they're driving south, or maybe it was in South Carolina, and he's thinking, where are we going? And not only that, but who are you that you can hold the secret from me? And she surprised him, and they went back to the inn where they were married.
How
which
wonderful.
I think was for her a way to get back to their relationship and try
and
to resume.
And what about Kate, whose husband apparently left her?
She had a very difficult time, and the first day we got home, I was with her, and we had just gotten back. And because she was now newly single, she didn't have her old home to go to. So she had arranged to rent a room in a friend's house, but she had never been there before. She had never slept there. So she's going home, but she was going home to a home she had never been in before. And that first night, she didn't want to stay there, so she stayed in a hotel. And the next morning, I went with her as we walk up to this sort of funny pink house that was, to her, completely odd. And she walks in and says to me, well, I guess this is home now. And her roommate was so loving and accommodating and took her in and very warm and shows her room. And there are all of her things in boxes from her past life just tucked away. And she opened a few of the boxes and then just says, I can't really look at that right now.
Tough times at 7 minutes before the hour. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Ben. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was listening earlier in the show. You were talking about the helicopter pilot that was 52 or 58, or I can't remember the age, but he was older. We just had, I work in Concord, which is north of Charlotte, and one of our city councilmen is a physician. And he just got shipped out to Afghanistan for a 6-month tour as a battalion surgeon, and he is 72. And he is a colonel in the Army Medical Corps, and they called him up. They needed him, and he said, well, you know, they need me, and I said I would go if they needed me. And we asked him, you know, are you the oldest guy out there? And he said, no, I have a colleague that is 78 that just got back.
Oh, so my gosh.
They're taking him, I guess, at any age. If you've been in the military and you're able to go, it seems like they're taking them at any age.
Well, if that's true, that's a remarkable story and one I'd like to write, if you can get in touch with me. But it does show how stretched we are. And one of the people I wrote about got called to go back with another unit 8 days after we got home. And they had warned him this might be a possibility because he had a special skill set. But there we were, been home for a week, and they called and said, there's another unit going in a few months. Would you go back?
Wow.
8 days after. So, well, he's home, but he was never really home.
Mm. And finally, to Marlon in Plantation, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. Thanks, Diane, for taking my call.
Sure.
I was just trying to make a comment about what your guest said earlier about how the Armed Forces went to war while the rest of America went to the mall. I think that it's hard to blame America for feeling that way when many people felt that they were misled in this war. It's hard to get America to rally behind the armed forces when they didn't feel that this was their war. They didn't feel that they were told the truth about it. So it's very hard to get support for them. As a former military member, I think that being honest about the reasons why we go to war is extremely important. And I think that the last administration didn't want people to know why we were going to war or the main reasons for.
Well, that's a fascinating comment. I guess one of the things I'd say is if there was a draft or if we were more connected as a society to our military, then those who felt we were misled perhaps would be protesting more. Because without a draft, we're not connected to it. It's not our sons and daughters who are going. So we sort of have this luxury that other people will go and fight. But if we were more connected to it and those who felt strongly against it, I would have to think there would be more of a Vietnam era response
protest,
to it.
And we're not seeing those Christian Davenport. His book is titled As You Were, To War and Back with the Black Hawk Battalion of the Virginia National Guard. Thank you so much for writing the book, for being there.
Thank you.
And I'll be off for the next couple of days, and I'll be back with you on Tuesday. I hope you have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.